following podcast is part of the Underdog Sports Podcasting Network. For a full list of our shows, as well as breaking sports news and engaging feature stories, visit us at www.theunderdogsports.com.
Tales from the Association, yeah, it's going down. This the podcast, yeah, you heard it all around. Players hit us with that career, cause you know that basketball, man, it's not always there. Sometimes it come and go from the recruitment to the college phase, back to the NBA draft, yeah, it's not days. Playing internationally, and at the life of the basketball, man, they're gonna tell us all how it go. See, sorry, it's held down, now you know. Tales from the Association, yeah.
Welcome to Tales from the Association. I'm Chris Horwardell. My guest today is former Kansas guard turned NBA second round pick Ryan Robertson. Ryan, thanks for coming on the show.
Happy to be on.
Oh, happy to have you. So let's talk about your basketball journey. You came out of St. Charles High School, had a strong career. You know, what was the college recruiting process like for you?
Well, I think it was probably pretty normal or usual, based on guys that were, I was very fortunate, very lucky. I was being recruited by some big-time programs. Mm-hmm. Obviously went to Kansas and had Coach Williams interested, but was considering Kentucky and Florida at the time. And I was really being heavily recruited by Missouri, which was my home state school. So, it was a lot of fun, and the attention was kind of neat. But at the same time, it was I was glad when it was all said and done being over, because I could really just focus on basketball and school and kind of get on with things. Mm.
You mentioned a couple of the basketball blue bloods recruiting you there. How much pressure did you feel to stay home and play at Missouri?
I felt a lot of pressure, actually. In fact, yesterday, Kansas and Missouri played an exhibition game where they raised $1.7 million for hurricane relief, and it was the first rivalry game that we've had in 5 years, because obviously Missouri left the Big 12 and there was some bad blood there. And they finally got together yesterday to play what I heard. I wasn't there, but what I heard was a really exciting, sort of exhilarating atmosphere and great game. And so I did feel a lot of pressure to go there. But at the end of the day, I just sort of felt a better, stronger connection to Roy Williams and the program, and as it all turned out, it was really the right decision for me.
Yeah, so was it ultimately Roy Williams that was the deciding factor, or what really made you pick Kansas over those other great schools?
I think it was twofold. Yeah, it was Coach Williams, it was my relationship with him, and he started recruiting me before anybody else, and so I had just a longer opportunity to build a relationship with him. But then at the end of the day, too, you kind of compare Kansas with maybe who else was on sort of your T chart, and you realize that, legacy or that history and program and Wilt Chamberlain and Danny Manning and Allen Fieldhouse and all the things that kind of come along with playing there at that school was just too hard to pass up.
Absolutely. So I actually had one of your former teammates on the show before, and we've talked a little bit about Coach Williams before, but I'd like to hear from you. What was playing for one of basketball's legendary coaches like for you?
Well, it wasn't easy. He was really demanding. He really pushed us to be the absolute best that he could be. I learned a ton about myself. I learned how tough I could be. I learned I got stronger mentally. I got stronger physically. I got better as a basketball player. But yet at the end of the day, I learned a ton. I was pushed to be better. And it made me better in my career today playing for Coach Williams than if I hadn't. And so I have a great appreciation for everything that he did for me now that I'm, a 41-year-old guy with a family and a job.
Right. So he is a guy who is very much, like you said, a coach who pushes people, but at the same time very much a coach who cares about his kids. Are you still in touch with him today?
I am. We talk not really regularly, but I will definitely talk to him usually at some point during the season and one point maybe after the season. Or, for example, they won the national championship last year. So I try and send him or talk to him right before the NCAA tournament, but then they got all the way to the national championship game. And so I made sure to reach out to the assistant coaches and to himself directly right before the game, just to wish him good luck and that we were thinking about him. And in those situations, you're obviously, even though I went to Kansas, I'm not rooting for North Carolina per se, but I'm definitely rooting for him and rooting for, you know, the for the assistant coaches and for the contacts that I still have there. So obviously thrilled for him that he was able to win his third national championship.
Absolutely. So I'm curious about this. Roy is not a young man anymore. Is he a texter or is he a phone call guy?
Yeah, it's a good question. He is he's not a texter. He is not I think he's one of these guys, frankly, that I think if he realized the value of text, he would become one, but I don't think he's willing to invest the time to learn how to text, if that makes sense. So he's an old school phone call guy. In fact, he pretty much is just an old school coach. I went to a practice last year and noticed that a lot of the same drills and a lot of the same sort of things that we did when I was in school at Kansas, he still does at North Carolina, and he just thinks that if it ain't broke, don't fix it, and it's really worked well for him.
Oh, exactly. He is not having any trouble with what he's been doing, so why change things?
Correct.
So you join a star-laden team at Kansas, and it took some time for you to crack the lineup under 9 minutes a game your freshman season. What's the adjustment like for you from high school to the college level?
Yeah, it was challenging. I guess the thing that I would give Coach Williams a lot of sort of, I really appreciated was I had games, especially towards the end of the year, where I played pretty substantial minutes and played a substantial role, and he kind of weaved me into that. But the thing that I appreciated the most was he got me into every single game, whether it was for 2 or 3 or 4 minutes or at the end of the season, 20, 25 minutes. And I was more appreciative of the 2 or 3 minutes early on in the season than I was of the 20, 25 at the end of the season, because I just felt like that was a really good investment into my career and something that, frankly, he didn't have to do. And that really meant a lot to me. So it was difficult transitioning from, you know, obviously a big role, All-American in high school, to sort of a secondary role or tertiary role even at KU. But it, you know, as the season went on, he gave me an opportunity to earn minutes, and I was able to do that.
Do you think some element of that is, you know, him kind of living up to whatever sort of recruiting promises are made, I guess, and making sure that you know that you are a part of this team and you're important to this team's future?
Well, I think the thing that most college coaches do, and I don't want to speak for Calipari or, you know, Izzo or any of these guys, because I don't know, but my view of Coach Williams and what he, you know, there was no promises on playing minutes. There were promises of, I want to win and I want what's best for our program. And if you're willing to sacrifice and if you're willing to work hard and get better, then, you know, you'll earn those minutes. And so I was never promised any sort of particular playing time. But at the same time, like I said, I was able to earn those minutes and that paid off towards the end of the year.
It seems like you were appreciative of the minutes you got. Was there ever a time where it was kind of went through your head like, well, this sucks and I want to play more even if it means leaving? Or were you always the guy like, I get it, I'll work harder and I'll earn my time?
You know, that's a good question. I don't think I was ever in the camp. I mean, you got to remember that was in, believe it or not, that's like 1995, 96, and the idea of transferring, you know, wasn't like it was today. Yeah. You know, nowadays, if a kid comes in and is unhappy with his situation, you know, he feels, I think there's more of a, you know, an openness to the idea of leaving. I just didn't feel that way. I was willing to stick it out, and unless situation got really sort of, I got really behind or really, in my view, unfair, then I would have considered it, but that wasn't the situation I was in. So I think to answer your question, the idea of transferring never came about. Now, was I frustrated? Did I have moments where I was sad or upset or disappointed with the amount of playing time I got as a freshman? Absolutely. And I think a lot of kids who come in as All-Americans probably go through the same thing I did, but I stuck with it and it paid out. It paid off.
How closely do you follow the program today?
Kansas?
Yeah.
Very closely. Yep.
Did you see any parallels between your scenario, your situation in college, and that of like a guy like Connor Frankamp coming in?
Well, you know, Connor was a great player, and I don't know him personally, but I do think that might be a good example of what we were talking about a second ago in regards to, you know, here's a guy that was. Now, I don't know what was going on behind the scenes with Coach Self and him and what their relationship was, but yes, I mean, here's a guy that came in pretty highly recruited, but he also had some really darn good players around him. And sure enough, he comes in, he earns some minutes late in the season, and then all of a sudden you realize that his sophomore year he's going to transfer. So, you know, are there some parallels there between me just deciding to stay there and stick it out and him deciding, you know what, maybe he'd have better opportunity somewhere else? Potentially, yes.
Okay. Sophomore year, big improvement for you. Your minutes double. Do you feel like you're on the right track at this point?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it wasn't good for our team, although it, you know, at the time, but our All-American point guard, Jack Vaughn, got hurt in preseason. He broke his wrist, which allowed me to start the first 11 games of the season. Obviously not ideal for him, but it did turn out pretty good for me in that I got, you know, an increased role and played a lot of more minutes and was put into that situation. And, it, you know, we went 11-0 in that time frame. We won the Maui Classic. We, you know, we beat the number one team in the country at the time, Cincinnati and Chicago. So we had some really big wins while I was starting. And then when he was able to come back and slide into that situation, you know, it was just, I think it added to the depth of our team.
Playing with Jock, did you ever think, oh, this guy's going to be an NBA head coach someday?
You know, I don't, it's sort of like, you know, playing with Paul Pierce. Do you look at Paul and go, hey, this guy's going to be in the Hall of Fame?
Yeah.
You know, you don't forecast out that far, I think. I think what you do is you look at the guy and go, listen, he's going to be a great NBA player, and he's really smart, he's really intelligent, he knows the game. So who knows, right? But the difference between being a 20-year-old college kid and going, hey, this guy, when he's 40, he's going to be in the Hall of Fame or be an NBA coach, that's tough to forecast out. So I can't say that I saw that, but since it's happened, I'm not surprised.
So your junior season, Jock and a friend of the show, Scott Pollard, are gone. Minutes open up, and you actually get the most minutes on the team and, you know, in front of guys like Paul and Rafe. You've got to be absolutely thrilled with where you're at this point.
Well, we were on a really good team. I mean, I had some, you know, I think Coach Williams appreciated the fact that I could play those minutes. He appreciated the fact that I was going to run the offense. And I, you know, at the time, I often told people, yeah, I'm playing a lot of minutes, but I also have the easiest job in the world because I come down and I throw the ball to Rafe LaFrenz or Paul Pierce, two first-team All-Americans, two guys that were going to end up, you know, being lottery picks. And, you know, they made me and others around us, you know, look good because they were so talented and so good at what they did. So, you know, the way I viewed it was, is I could only screw things up by, you know, getting in their way. And my job was pretty easy because, as I said, I had them around me.
I remember Eric Snow once said that his job as a point guard was to dribble the ball up court and get it to LeBron James. Is that kind of what you felt like?
That's exactly what I felt like. As I said, I mean, you know, if I came down, I mean, the truth is if I came down and turned it over, you know, that was a huge loss for our team because getting it to Paul or Ray, there was such a high probability of them scoring or making something good happen that it was almost a double whammy. You know, like at least if I shot it, you know, then it was sort of the opportunity we were going to still score because I was a relatively good shooter and others around me were good shooters. But, you know, turning the ball over was a really bad scenario for our team just because we had so many good options on the offensive end.
And that last year, Paul and Rafe leave. What is your thought process here? Are you excited that this is now my team, or are you a little heartbroken to lose those guys?
Well, Rafe graduated, and to be honest with you, I don't think I was in the camp of I was excited that it was going to be my team. I would have been more than happy to share that with Paul, but I also at the same time felt like we were lucky to have him for 3 years. He stayed probably 1 year longer than he could have, and so the fact that we got him to stay through his junior year was a real added bonus. So I knew that we were not going to be probably as good, especially initially when the season started, because we had lost two lottery picks. But at the same time, I did feel like we had some real opportunity to let younger players step up and get some big time minutes.
Yeah, you mentioned it being a different time in college basketball. I don't see a scenario where a Paul Pierce lasts to his junior year in college at this point.
No. I mean, you know, and listen, the money has gotten so big, not that it wasn't big at the time, but, you know, you could potentially talk a guy, you know, out of leaving because of the situation that they were in and because they could better their situation or whatever. But nowadays, you know, you're talking $20-$40 million on the table that you could be potentially leaving behind. Now it's just too difficult for a top tier guy not to want to go.
So having played with that big four, you know, I'll assume that you thought that Paul was going to have the best NBA career of the group. Of the other three, is there anyone you're a little bit surprised by how they either overperformed or underperformed in the NBA? And when I say underperformed, I know a lot of that is situational opportunity.
No, I mean, you know, Jock Vaughn played 10-plus years, was an NBA coach. Scott Pollard was a 15, you know, I don't know if he played 15 years, but he was definitely 12, 13 years in the NBA, won a world championship with the Celtics. Paul is going to go to the Hall of Fame. Rafe was, again, a guy that made a ton of money for several different organizations and could do a bunch of different things. So, no, I mean, I look at all four of those guys and think to myself, you know, good for them that they had such long careers and were able to do what they were able to do in the NBA. And, you know, good for them.
Can I tell you, one of the real treats about doing this show has been kind of getting to see how the perceptions, the public perceptions of people are incorrect. And Scott Pollard, that's an interesting guy. And I was shocked by just how well that went.
How well what went?
Having him on the show, I was a little bit apprehensive, to be honest, because, you know, there is this perception of Scott's this crazy guy, and you see that sort of...
He's crazy. He's a nut.
Yes, but...
He's wacky. He is completely wacky.
Sure, but also, like, from my experience at least, like, a nice, thoughtful guy.
Yeah, I can't say enough great things about Scott. I love him like a... I don't know if I love him like a brother, but it's pretty close. I mean, the guy, he and I have had a lot of great times together and spent a lot of time together. I mean, beside the fact being a great teammate at Kansas and one of the all-time greats at Kansas, he also was, I got drafted in the second round and played in Sacramento, and he was on that team. And so he and I were pretty inseparable for that year that I was there. And I got to tell you, he took really good care of me and, you know, he didn't need to protect me. I'm not trying to say that,
yeah,
but I mean,
yeah,
he definitely kind of showed me the ropes and watched over me and was sort of a big brother at the time. And so I can't say enough great things about Scott Pollard and what he's meant to my life.
Yeah, he is not what the media makes him out to be by any stretch of the imagination.
Well, the only thing I would say about that, you know, a lot of that is he brought it on. He's brought a lot of that on himself, whether it's the crazy haircuts or, you know, the goatees or the big paint, you know, fingernail painting or some being on Survivor. Like, he's attracted a lot of attention on his own. But the reality is, you're right. I mean, he's a thoughtful guy. He cares a lot about the game. He knows a lot about the game, and he has great insight into the game. And so I think he has a lot to bring to the table for sure.
Also an extremely honest man, for better or worse.
Well, right. He doesn't why would you not be if you were him, right? I mean, he has nothing to hide or nothing to, you know, he has no reason not to be completely sort of out there because he doesn't care. And that's
right.
If you're in the media, I would think that that's a really sort of good thing to have in front of a microphone.
Oh, no question. And he's verbose. These tend to go about 35 minutes and, you know, give or take 10. But I think I talked to Scott for about 90 minutes, and it was just because he kept talking and talking and talking, and that was wonderful.
Yeah. No, you get him talking about basketball, he can go on for a long time.
Or literally anything. But let's get back to you. Like you mentioned, you were the number 45 pick of the Kings in 99. What are you going through on draft night? What did you think your range was?
You know, I thought it was late second round, if anything. I think I had some options to potentially be a free agent and, you know, make a few summer rosters. But when the Kings finally selected me at 45, I can't say I was shocked because I did have a very good workout with them. Mm-hmm. I enjoyed my workout with them. I got along really well with the people that were there. I kind of showcased my skills well during that workout. So I think that went well. And so when they did finally pick me, as I said, I wasn't shocked. But I was walking into a situation that I felt was a really good one.
And how hectic was the lead up to the draft? I mean, I hear people telling horror stories about, you know, 17 workouts in 15 days. What was that experience like for you?
Well, for me, because I was going to be, you know, I wasn't projected to be a first round pick. I was projected more to be a second round pick. And the other thing you have to remember is that for 4 years I was playing with, again, Paul Pierce and Rafe LaFrenz and Scott Pard and all these guys that were getting a ton of attention. I had, at most of our games, we had, you know, 10 or 15, 20 scouts at most of our games. And, you know, we even, because of it being Kansas, we would have scouts come to practice. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure I had that hectic of a schedule leading up to the draft, just because every one of our games was on national television. And as I said, we had, you know, a lot of scouts being at our games anyway. So I just felt like, leading up to it, I had 4 or 5 workouts, not the 15 or 16 that you're talking about, based upon the fact that, you know, these guys had seen me play quite a bit.
Right, people knew who you were at that point.
Absolutely.
Still, I think there's some benefit to getting a guy in a gym and getting to look at him face-to-face and ask questions to find out who he really is.
And that's true, right? And I think that's absolutely true. But again, you know, I was being projected to be a second-round pick, so I don't think that there was this... you know, there wasn't a huge market for what I was bringing to the table.
Right. So you get drafted. What's it like to walk into that facility for the first time, being a professional, being on a team with guys like Chris Webber?
Yeah, it was pretty intimidating, actually, and it was pretty awe-inspiring and all the things that you can imagine. I'm not sure I was quite ready for that moment. I wasn't sure, even though I was a mature guy, I'm not sure I was really quite understanding of the situation that I was walking into, and the job, quote unquote, that it really took to be an NBA player. I think I understand it more now that I'm an older guy, and I understand what it's like to have a job and understand what it's like the work that it takes to be the best. But I'm not disappointed in the situation. I'm not disappointed in how it all worked out. You know, I think it worked out the way it should have worked out. Chris Webber was an unbelievable teammate. Vlade Divac was on that team. He was unbelievable to be around. Jason Williams was, you know, incredible to watch every single night. So for that year, I got a big time basketball tutelage, no doubt about it.
Yeah, there's this, you know, perception that being an NBA player is this incredibly glamorous thing. And sure, elements of it are, but people don't understand the work that is necessary. How hard is it to actually be an NBA player in terms of that being your full-time job?
Well, listen, I mean, I think there, I don't know LeBron James at all, and so I don't want to discount what he does. I'm not going to do that because I know he works incredibly hard, but there are still those in the NBA that are so gifted and so talented that when they add their level of work ethic to it, it makes them Hall of Fame caliber or LeBron James caliber type guys. And so I'm sure that's what he's clearly one of the most talented guys that's ever lived, and he works incredibly hard, and thus he's going to be one of the all-time great players. For me, what I didn't realize was I got to the NBA based upon what I had always done in high school and in college, and that was, you know, let's say that was just staying after, shooting, working on weights, doing the things that needed to be done, and that was good enough. But in the NBA, in order to be that 12th, 13th, 14th guy on the roster, which I was, you have to remember that, you know, you're sort of like just barely, so the view you have to have is you're barely hanging on to the league. And in order to stay there, you got to fight like heck to keep that position. And so just doing a little bit extra, which had always gotten me through, you know, high school and college, just wasn't going to be good enough. And see, I wasn't mature enough or experienced enough to realize that at the time, and it didn't really dawn on me until years past that that's what it would have taken.
Right. I've had other people tell me that, you know, there's, say, 50, 75 guys in the NBA that are clearly better than everybody else, and then, you know, maybe the next 1,000 best basketball players in the world are all pretty close in terms of talent. Do you think that's fair?
I think that's probably a little bit. I would say there's probably, you know, if there's 350 guys in the NBA, I would say there's probably 200 that are clear above everybody else, and then the next 150 are sort of up in the air, and then that there's probably, instead of being 1,000 guys, there's probably 500. So, again, you know, again, the gap in the margin between, you know, the last five guys on a roster and the best five guys in Europe is razor thin.
Absolutely. So you get in one game with the Kings that year, and you actually play 25 minutes, which has got to be nice. Do you have any regrets from that? What was your takeaway from that game?
No, I mean, you know, listen, I think if I, again, it was sort of a weird experience because I had sat there for 81 games, and all of a sudden I'm being thrust into, you know, not really knowing what I'm going to do or how much I'm going to play, and getting to play 25 minutes was great. But, you know, I was okay with being, you know, I'm looking at the box score right now because it's framed in my office. And, you know, remembering back to that night, I had 5 points and, you know, did whatever I did. So I guess knowing how it would have turned out, should I have been like Allen Iverson that night and literally shot it every single time I touched it? You know, I guess I sometimes have daydreams about that, but as it all played out, I'm fine with what happened.
Sure. I mean, in hindsight, that would have been wonderful, but at the time, I imagine, you know, you're not thinking this is my last NBA game, and you can't go out and shoot the ball 30 times. That's not going to look good for a potential employer.
Well, the other thing, too, and then again, this goes back to sort of really having the mindset to be an NBA player, is I got to be honest, I think that game, I was really more concerned about not messing up and not making a fool of myself than I was going out there and trying to win a job and win a game and really present myself in a marketable way. And that's the mistake I made. And that was sort of, again, not having the maturity level or not having the experience level to understand what it takes to be an NBA. I mean, the NBA doesn't want guys that are just going to, you know, not make mistakes. They want to have guys that add to their roster and add to winning. And, you know, that night I performed fine, but I didn't perform at a level that made somebody go, you know what, this guy can add something to our roster.
Right, but so isn't part of that just dumb luck too? Because there certainly are those guys who are out there just who don't make mistakes. Look at, you know, TJ McConnell in Philadelphia.
Well, I think a lot of times, too, it comes down to opportunities, right? I mean, the fact of the matter is that year I was on injured reserve for 81 out of 82 games. Mm-hmm. And the reason for that was not necessarily because of my level of play. It was because that year we had maybe one injury that caused the guy to go on injured reserve.
Yeah.
And I was also on injured reserve that entire year with Bill Winnington, who played on those great Bulls teams, and he was a veteran guy. And so he was sort of ahead of me. And so when we had an injury that year, and it was John Barry who had a little back spasm issue, he got put on injured reserve for 5 games, and Bill Winnington just slid into that position. But when you think about 81 games, you would have thought, you know what? Jason Williams, Nick Anderson, Tony Dell, Derek Martin, any of these guys that were kind of playing in front of me, that they would have twisted an ankle and I wasn't hoping for that, but you just would have thought over the course of a long season that they would have gotten nicked up somehow, that it would have caused them to go on injured reserve, and that never happened. Right. And so that caused me not to have more opportunities and get more comfortable with being, you know, on an NBA roster and on an NBA court, and that just never happened.
I love this, the old fake injury to get you on the IR thing. What did they tell you your injury was? Do you remember?
You know, it was left knee tendonitis. and I had left knee tendonitis for, you know, 6 months. It's all, I don't even know if they do that anymore. I think, you know, now they have the D League or the G League or whatever it's called. And so I'm not even sure that they have this, you know, fake injury thing. It was all sort of semantics. You're right. And, you know, sort of confusing, but that's what was listed for the reasons why I wasn't dressed for a game.
Bigger rosters now, too. You have the 15-man roster.
Yeah, bigger rosters, correct.
So after that, the timeline's a little bit murky with when you were with the Cagers. That was immediately after the Kings?
Yeah, you've done some nice research there. Actually, I got to remember. I actually think that Cagers was in between my college and in between I got drafted. Okay. I was just doing that as sort of to stay sharp. It was like a minor league team, and it was in Salina, Kansas, not far from where I went to school, and my grandparents lived in Salina at the time, so it made sense for me to play four or five games, but, not real memorable, performances or league for that matter.
Sure. Yeah, it's not clear whether, online, whether or not that was before or after. So what I can say for sure is that after that, you're with the Kansas City Knights of the ABA. I'm sure you had offers to play internationally. Was this a move to try and sort of both stay close to home and stay close to the NBA with your eye on potential eventual return?
That's exactly right. Kevin Pritchard, who, is now the general manager of the Indiana Pacers and has been coach of the Portland Trailblazers. He was the coach. He was the general manager. He had played at Kansas. He convinced me to come play for them. I played one season. I enjoyed it. But it was absolutely a kind of a view that I thought, I'm not sure I want to go to Europe. And it does give me an opportunity to stay closer to the NBA. So let's give that a shot. But I think what I ultimately then decided was my wife sort of talked me into, I was married at the time, still am, but, my wife kind of talked me into, hey, let's give the Europe thing a chance. Let's see what it's like over there. Even though I didn't want to go, I was kind of fighting that. Cause I had heard horror stories about playing in Europe and it wasn't really something that I wanted to do, but it ended up being, I was over there for 5 years and it ended up being, fantastic years, five of the best years of my life, actually. Really, really enjoyed it. It was really good for basketball. It was really good for, my wife and I to really travel around and see the world. And I just had a blast over there. And it was a really positive thing in my life.
Yeah, it seems like in terms of international basketball, people either have very good experiences or very poor experiences with little in between.
Yeah, I mean, I think now there's more education about what leagues are good and what your experience is going to be like. And the game has gotten more international anyway, so I think the international teams know as well what they're dealing with. So I think it's a better situation now, but I had a good agent. Mm. He kind of steered me in a couple of really good spots, and so it all worked out pretty well.
So that first stop was in the Netherlands with Eiffel Towers. I'm not going to even try that next part of that. How did that come about? A positive experience playing in the Netherlands?
Yeah, I mean, Holland was awesome. We really loved it. We had two other Americans on the team that we became very close with, my wife and I. And then, the Dutch people are beautiful people. They speak great English. The basketball was good. They paid you on time. Mm-hmm. So it was just a really great experience and three really good years there. We won, a couple of championships, and I was MVP of the league, and it really sort of helped. I will say it was some of the best basketball that I've ever played, my time in Holland. And so I look back at that time being, really positive.
Why do you think that is? Do you think that's because of the trust and confidence they showed in you? Do you think that's your development as a basketball player? Or, and to some degree, I imagine it is a slightly lower level of competition.
Yeah, so I think what ultimately happened was is, when you get to Europe, you're playing a lot less games and you're practicing a lot more. And my time in the NBA was marked by, because I was the 15th guy on the roster, you weren't getting to play a ton. So I was trying to keep myself sharp and busy by running sprints and shooting extra. And, you're just not getting a lot of practice time in the NBA. Like, the guys that are practicing are really spending most of their time, like Chris Webber's of the world, they're getting most of the reps. Mm-hmm. It's not me, So, when I got to Europe, the two practices a day, and it just kind of got me back into mentally and physically being ready and prepared to play basketball at a really high level. And then, getting to play close to 40 minutes a game every single night. It was just great development for my basketball career.
You talk about the physical element of it. How tough and how rigorous is the like an NBA schedule where you are flying from town to town every other night, getting in at 2 a.m.? How tough is that to have yourself right physically?
Well, again, for me, it wasn't that challenging because I wasn't playing. But when I sat back and watched Chris Webber and what he was able to do night in and night out, like the year I was there, I think he finished third in the MVP voting that year behind like Kobe and Shaq or something. I mean, he just had an incredible year. And every night was, you know, doing 20 or 30 and 10. And, you know, his performance that year was incredible. And, you know, to see him be able to perform at that level every single night, you know, I didn't know how he did it, to be honest with you. And when I look at, you know, the LeBron Jameses of the world and, you know, the Allen Iversons and the guys that were just playing incredible minutes and the pounding that they take, I don't know how they're able to physically answer the bell every single night like that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, as a 76ers fan myself, what Allen did was incredible. Just completely incredible. I watched that guy get beat up quarter by quarter in every single game. And, you know, he would not sit, and he would not sit out with a minor injury. It's sort of a very different mindset as opposed to what we have today in the NBA where, you know, guys have to rest in the back end of a doubleheader or, you know, you know what I mean. And it's just, that was never him.
Nope. And, you know, I do think there's a different mindset now. I do think people are starting to realize the value of rest. And, you know, I think the league is also starting to understand that those maybe back-to-backs aren't optimal for the fans and optimal for the teams, and so they've cut them back. But regardless, some of these guys that are able to answer the bell every single night is pretty remarkable.
Yeah, like I said, as a Sixers fan, back-to-backs are dirty words to me because that means we're not going to get Joel for one of those games. So
yeah,
how do you think? So you would agree with the NBA's decision this year to sort of move the time frame of the start of the league up a little bit and eliminate some of those back-to-backs then?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, just because, like, as a fan, I don't want to, like, I know last year there was a back-to-back where, and the Spurs are famous for this, but like a back-to-back where Clay, Steph, Draymond, you know, didn't play in a game. Mm-hmm. Well, if I'm a fan and I go to that game and I don't get to watch them, that, you know, or I'm on TV or I paid for DirecTV, you know, full court or whatever it is, and I don't get to watch them play, That's not a great situation for the NBA, but if I'm Steve Kerr and I'm trying to do what's absolutely best for my team in order to win a championship, then, you know, I'm going to sit up. So I think, you know, the league has recognized the fact that there's got to be, you know, an in-between there, and so they've tried to alleviate that problem as best they can.
So you head to Greece next. What's that single season like for you in Greece?
You know, it was great. Athens is an incredible city, big city, but, you know, it was sort of a weird transition year for me because we had just had our first child. And so I was living in a really big city and I just left Holland where they spoke beautiful, perfect English to Greece where they didn't speak very good English. I had a brand new baby. So I was sort of the first taste of, I was like, you know, I'm not sure that, you know, I want to continue to play overseas. It was the first time I had started to think about, hey, does it make sense to keep going this route and not get back to, you know, back home and back to St. Louis. And so I enjoyed my basketball there, but it was the first sort of smells of, hey, I think I might be getting close to being done.
Right. Where was the child born? Was it born in Holland or in the United States?
No. So she was born actually in the summer back at home and taken at home. But then, but she was brand newborn, and then I had to leave to go to Greece. So I had to be separated from her. And then my wife and my mom came over. It just sort of, you know, it went from just being my wife and I and being very easy to travel around to now all of a sudden being in a foreign country with a brand new, you know, a newborn, and it made the situation a little bit more complex.
Yeah, that's got to be impossible for you because, I mean, it's an impossible situation today, but, you know, you have FaceTime, you have Skype, you have all of that stuff, and I imagine that technology wasn't, you know, quite as far along at that point.
Yeah, and I would say it was an impossible situation. I mean, people were doing it. It just, for me personally, it just wasn't optimal. It's not what I was envisioning my life to be, to live in Greece and to have a baby back at home. And, you know, so it just, as I said, it was sort of the beginning of the end in my mind.
Right, and as that career is winding down a little bit, you're back in the ABA with the St. Louis Flight. Is this just, you know, you were sick of being overseas and let's get back to playing in America?
Yeah, it was sort of one of these deals, you know, you hear these horror stories. So beside the fact that, you know, I was separated from my wife and baby for a period of time in Greece, they also, and Greece is pretty infamous for this, they started to be, they were delaying their paychecks to me. So I fell about 6 weeks behind what they owed me. And it was about Christmas time. So I'd been playing there for 4 or 5 months. And about Christmas time, you know, they told me that they were going to not pay me for, you know, November. And they were going to pay me, but they just weren't going to do it until January. And
sure.
I said, well, you know, this isn't pro bono work. I'm not, you know, I want to be compensated for what I'm doing. It was Christmas, it was like right before Christmas. And I said, listen, here's the deal. I'm not playing in the game tomorrow night unless I get paid today after practice. And, you know, they just didn't pay me. So I got on the plane and I left. So, you know, Greece still owes me about $15,000. I'm not holding my breath that I get that money. But if you know any good Greek lawyers, I do. I am still owed about $15,000.
I will keep that in mind. So ABA, and we have one last international season. You're back in France. What led to the time in France? And you know, afterwards, did you just kind of know I'm ready to move on to the next stage?
Yeah, I mean, I had a great experience in France. It was a very good team. I joined them. It was a really good experience. I played a lot. We got to play in some big time venues. But again, it just, I got home that summer and I had another opportunity to go back to Europe and play in Italy, which was a country I'd never played in before, meaning long-term. And it was with a really good established team and a long-term contract. So it was a very positive development. And I just, that summer, I just wasn't excited about it. It was like the first time I had ever, like, got back and was almost like when my agent called and said, hey, I've got this for you, I was almost sort of disappointed almost because I just kind of felt like my time in Europe was done. I didn't want to go over there anymore. I didn't want to battle, you know, the kind of being away from home and all that. And so I basically, my wife and I decided at that point that we were just going to kind of call it a day and move on with the next chapter of our life.
How much do you think your time in Greece colored that decision? You know, if that goes differently and you're paid on time and that experience is more positive, are you more open to, you know, potentially continuing at that point, do you think?
Potentially, but doubtful. I mean, here is the reality of it. The situation was this is, you know, I'm not complaining about the money. I mean, I was making it, the money was fine, but it wasn't like I was making so much money that another 5 or 6 years in Europe meant that I could retire. Right. I mean, I was making enough money to live comfortably and, you know, to pay my mortgage and to travel and, you know, have a job, but it wasn't like I was making so much money, as I said, that I could just, you know, I was stacking away tons of cash. And so, you know, that combined with, I married my high school sweetheart and I promised her that, you know, when we were done in Europe, and she was supportive always and always has been supportive, but, you know, when I was done, we'd get back to St. Louis and live closer to home and find something a little bit more, you know, day to day, so to speak. And so that's just what we decided to do.
I think in terms of relationships, especially with professional athletes, that's kind of the best case scenario, because you do hear a lot of people talk about, you know, I got married in my fourth year in the NBA and people get accustomed to a certain lifestyle. But with you guys, it seems like maybe you were always looking forward to that time after basketball.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. I think, you know, we both enjoyed the travel. We both enjoyed the experience. It was really sort of enjoyable at the time. But at the, you know, back of our minds, we always knew that we would be back here in St. Louis in our hometown and start to raise a family. And that's what we've done.
Very cool. And so in 2012, you're credited in the movie The Hat Goes Wild. How did this come about?
I have no idea what that is.
Is that true?
I don't even know what you're talking about.
That's funny.
The first time I've ever heard that.
That is funny. I was going through the Wikipedia page and your pro basketball reference and all that today to get ready for this. And if you check your Wikipedia page, you will see. Well, if you search for yourself in Google, you will see that you were allegedly credited in the movie The Hat Goes Wild. And there is, in fact, a Ryan Robertson in that movie. I looked it up, but apparently not you.
The Hat Goes Wild. I mean, honestly, I've never even heard of that.
Oh, no. From what what I saw on IMDb, there is no reason you would have ever heard of this. This is it's a 4.5 out of 10 stars. Not exactly a good movie, and it looks like it's a Canadian film. So, well, congratulations for being in that, even if you weren't.
Oh my gosh, I'm online right now looking at it, and no, I had nothing to do with this, and I'm mad that I'm not, like, this is the first I've ever heard of it.
I wonder if you have an IMDb. You do, in fact, have an IMDb page. So, I mean, well, some Ryan Robertson does, but you can say it's you. Well, anyway, all right, so before we get out of here, I want to play a quick word association game, which I like to do with everybody. First thing that comes to your mind when I mention these names doesn't have to be one word or anything like that, just, you know, first thoughts. So let's go with some ex-teammates here. You got Paul Pierce.
Hall of Fame.
Jock Vaughn.
Man, I look up to him. I just, I have this, he was just somebody that when I was there, I sort of looked up to and wanted to sort of model myself after. And he was an academic All-American and I was an academic All-American. I just have a great deal of respect for him.
The consummate college point guard. You can certainly have worse people to look up to.
Yeah.
How about Scott Pollard?
Again, big brother, zany, wacky, funny, great to be around, full of life, just somebody I'm glad I got to know over the course of my career.
Rafe LaFrance.
Wicked talented. When I think of Rafe LaFrance, I think of, you know, that 6'10 guy who was able to do a fall away sort of, you know, on the block jumper that nobody could stop. It was just a shot I can still see in my head. And, you know, he was so good at it. You just give him the ball on the block and he was able to score.
Yeah. Do you think maybe he has an even more impressive career if he comes along 10 years later?
Probably. Yeah. But I think that's very fair.
How about Nick Anderson?
A good teammate. But it was sort of at the end of his career. So I think the Kings were hoping that they were going to get more out of him than he was really able to give. And so that sort of marriage didn't ultimately work out. Not that it was anybody's fault. It just he was sort of at the end of his career and a little bit more, let's say, veteran than they had hoped.
Sure. John Barry.
Still one of my, you know, good buddies. I think he's super talented on the radio and on television. Basketball family, and again, somebody that while I played in Sacramento was really good to me.
How about Vlade?
Awesome teammate. You know, he's sort of the NBA or the, you know, Yugoslavian Michael Jordan, and huge overseas and in Europe, and, you know, just he was sort of a famous basketball player, and it was fun to be in the same locker room with him.
Yeah, I mean, you talk about not being able to project people, what they're going to be 15 years later, but, man, I would not have guessed Vlade is the general manager of the Kings.
Yeah, well, you know, he had a great career in Sacramento, and, you know, I think he's doing some nice things there for sure.
How about Peja Stojakovic?
You know, he was one of the first sort of, you know, the European player. Mm-hmm. He and Vlade were sort of some of the first guys over. And an incredible shooter, one of the all-time great three-point shooters, but somebody that I think as a European was sort of, you know, hadn't quite grasped exactly what the NBA was all about.
Gotcha. Chris Webber.
One of the best teammates I ever had, Hall of Famer, just remarkably talented, and, you know, somebody I probably remembers me, and I could jog his memory about some of the times we had, but regardless, he made a big impact in my life.
Yeah, of the you know, I've been lucky enough to have a couple of people on who have been teammates with Chris, and no one has anything short of just glowing terms to talk about him.
I was a nobody on the team. Like I told you, I was 13th or 14th on the bench, and he was just a great, great teammate.
But Jason Williams,
wicked talented, impossible to guard. He was a wild animal, and so he was really hard to cage and really hard to tame as a coach. Mm-hmm. I think he drove our coaches absolutely wild and nuts and crazy, but incredible to watch.
The Jason Williams Randy Moss commercial, still one of the greatest commercials of all time.
Yeah, that relationship was pretty remarkable and unique for sure.
And how about last guy is Big Corliss Williamson.
You know, again, another famous, so somebody that loves basketball. I mean, he came from those great Arkansas teams and won a national championship and sort of a famous basketball player and was a great teammate. He really was. Didn't spend a lot of time with Corliss, but he was always very sort of, fair to me and nice to me and just, a good pro.
Sure. All right, so is there anything you want to plug before we get out of here?
No, I'm not selling anything. I appreciate you running me through some good, fun memories. That's for sure, though.
Oh, I appreciate your time. So this has been this week's episode of Tales from the Association. My guest has been Ryan Robertson. Ryan, really, thanks so much for coming on. I had a good time talking to you.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.